Okay, well, why don't we get started? As usual, I am still and remain John Beck, the co-director of our Daily Work of Daily Lives. So I can't thank you enough for coming out. You know, Greg, I think this is your
second time.
I thought I was trying to think of whether or not we had actually done it three times, but this is Greg's second time to come to our Daily Work of Daily Lives, and so I'm very, very happy to have. A southeastern Michigan guy, right, who lives in Pennsylvania.
Maryland.
I'll get Frostburg State, you know, in the right place sooner or later. But let me just hand out some quick things about next week. The title's changed. That doesn't mean the topic's changed, but the title's changed. So William Riddell will be in from the History Department at the University of Toronto. And the new title of his talk is A Leak in the Ship of State, the Sailors' Union of the Pacific, and the Imperial Labor Politics of Pacific Annexation, 1897 to 1900. And you might remember Dan Bender from the University of Toronto. William is one of his PhD students and very, very gifted. I would commend to you, if you haven't been on the ground floor, to see the photos and other things that we have in the exhibit, Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters. We have a number of things coming up in connection to that exhibit. There's currently a companion exhibit over at the MSU Library. And coming up in the exhibit, you'll see there's two poems by Cindy Hunter Morgan. And there's also a poem, I believe, over in the library from her same forthcoming collection from Wayne State University Press, which are all Great Lakes Shipwreck poems. And so Cindy is a very talented poet. So we have the photos by William Brozek, we have the poems by Cindy Hunter Morgan and others. And this is, so I just sent around the thing about all of the activities we have coming up. This is about the brown bag that we have coming up with Brozek, which is capturing the iron hulls from the inside. Worker, photographer, photographer, worker. And last but not least, I'll send around the entire thing, perfect for wrapping fish or putting it on your refrigerator or wherever you'd like to use them. But it's the rest of the fall series. Okay. I'm very happy that that Greg is back with us. And the interesting thing is he's added a new project. I believe the other one is coming out in book form, or still working on that?
It's going to come out in the fall, The History of Smoking in the Workplace, when I had presented on the Triangle Fire earlier.
Right.
It's finally coming out now.
And Greg and I have been together in numerous places, both presenting at the same time, and I've heard a variety of the work that has come out of his pieces on his history of smoking in the workplace, which is really quite something. But today he's going to talk on a totally different topic.
This is brand new, indeed.
Brand new. And many of us are aware of kind of the important history interaction between General Motors here in the state of Michigan and the rise of the United Auto Workers. And the one period that we probably don't know all that much about by comparison is the real time frame that Greg's going to help us with today. He's a history professor at Frostburg State, which is in Maryland. Greg is talking today on the subject, GM Never Surrendered, on anti-union politics in the automobile industry in the 1960s and 70s. So please help me in giving a warm welcome to Greg Wood.
Thank you, everybody. Again, this research is brand new. It's something that I'm starting to get into over the past few months. And many of the sources that I'm using for this particular paper are National Labor Relations Board cases from the 1960s, mostly, but also in the early 70s. And I wanted to sort of work from my essay draft so I could get feedback on what I've written, as opposed to me trying to explain what it is that I've written. So the organizing victories of the United Automobile Workers Union in the auto factories of the 1930s and 40s heralded major working class victories over employers' anti-union practices during the early to mid 20th centuries. Auto workers' victories in Flint, Detroit, Dearborn at the large factories of GM, the Ford Motor Company, and Chrysler between 1937 and 1945 signaled a high watermark for organized labor and pointed to a significant break with the past, as organized workers now had imposed on employers a new balance of power and a new semblance of democracy in what were now closed shops. Labor and working class historians master narratives of the labor movement in the 20th century auto industry. Most frequently consider the theme of anti-union measures as a set of wrongs that reside in the industry's sordid and brutal past and were checked by unionization from below. While discussions of anti-union culture and practices reemerge in analyses of the auto industry's later turn to the union-free labor markets of the southern U.S. and the global south, scholars' approaches to anti-union practices in the auto industry have neglected the persistence and the forms of anti-union culture on the shop floors of unionized auto plants in the post-World War II years. Beyond the auto industry, in labor historians' examinations of anti-union culture and politics more generally, there is a similar tendency to locate anti-union practices in unorganized workplaces and the contested union drives to organize these sites. As several of these studies suggest, the significance of anti-union culture is presumed to end with the unionization of unorganized workplaces, more specifically, the beginning of contractual relations and/or the failure of organized labor to organize workers in these disputed places. At the same time, labor historians rightly point to the influence and even prevalence of anti-union politics in the legislative halls of government, where anti-union political voices wield considerable influence, as well as journalism and print media, where pundits and political hacks vociferously promote an anti-union culture that derides the labor movement. Seeking to push this conversation among labor historians into lesser-known terrain, my paper looks behind the doors of the closed shop in an effort to highlight some of the ongoing, everyday presence of anti-union culture and its forms in auto industry workplaces, including the UAW's historic base of its strength, that is Michigan. This paper focuses on two factories in the GM system, one being the General Motors Pontiac Division plant in Pontiac, Michigan, but also in the second half, I segue to Chevrolet Van Nuys in California, both in the early to mid-1960s. As post-World War II conflicts at Pontiac and also Van Nuys over managers' treatment of UAW committeemen and their handling of union bulletin boards showed, anti-union politics on auto industry shop floors outlasted the labor wars of the 30s and the 40s. Perhaps, as I would argue, GM never surrendered. The shop floors of unionized auto plants of the post-war years continued to be battlegrounds over the status and the presence of organized labor, as various NLRB cases demonstrated. I want to begin with a 1959 case, a complaint to the National Labor Relations Board that was filed by Pontiac UAW committeeman Wallace R. O'Neill in retaliation for an unauthorized walkout of machine repairmen on the third shift and committeeman O'Neill's failure to force them back to work. General Motors management swiftly fired O'Neill for not fulfilling his contractual duty to enforce the union's negotiated no-strike promise in the UAW-GM contract. Managers later adjusted the punishment to a 30-day disciplinary layoff. The O'Neill case highlights that while the darkest days of anti-labor terror may have been over at General Motors, there remained the presence of harassment and subterfuge that was anti-union in its tone and in its outcomes. In the brave new world of contractual labor relations in the post-World War II auto industry, management and union officials continued to struggle over the status and the power of organized labor in these workplaces of the post-sit-down, closed-shop era. Wallace O'Neill's battle with GM management began as a result of his co-workers' frustrations with mandatory overtime on the weekend of April 11, 1959. And their subsequent refusal to work. On Friday, April 10, the repairmen observed that managers posted a notice that said they would be required to work extra time on the evening of Saturday, April 11, for a total of 6.5 hours. provoking an impromptu strategy session among the men that included their committee man, Wallace O'Neill. During the unhappy talk among workers about the obligatory overtime, O'Neill later claimed that he told them, quote, they had better come in or they would be subject to penalty, end quote, in accordance with the contract. While O'Neill insisted he thought the men's refusal to work was, quote, left up in the air, the other men stated they had a general understanding that no one would stay overtime on Saturday night. On the next day, as the third shift approached, all of the repairmen began punching out and exiting quickly for the parking lot. When the GM master mechanic, William Killen, ordered the men to stay, they refused to do so. Killen knew of their frustration with the mandatory overtime, so he immediately notified the assistant personnel director at the Pontiac plant, a man named Joseph H. Schimmick, that a, quote, concerted refusal, end quote, to work was underway. Later, as Killen and another manager circulated the area and tried to convince the men to remain, they were all curtly refused. One claimed he had to meet his spouse at the factory gate so he could be driven home. Another claimed he was feeling ill. As Joseph Schimmick of the personnel office spoke to master mechanic William Killen, Killen called over Wallace O'Neill to explain the situation himself. O'Neill continued to claim there was absolutely nothing he could do since all of the men were leaving work too abruptly and quickly, as they usually did every night. O'Neill himself was soon to leave to go home, insisting he had done everything he could to keep the men on the job. Schimmick then instructed Killen to, quote, watch O'Neill to see what, if anything, he did, end quote. According to Killen, now an improvised labor spy for the personnel office, O'Neill failed to help get the men to stay for the overtime shift. Supposedly, quote, he made no effort to get the men back to work, end quote. Immediately, management moved against O'Neill. Pontiac managers that included William Killen, the master mechanic, and Robert Shans, a General Motors labor relations official, interviewed each of the repairmen on Monday, April 13th. They learned from these interviews that all of the men had decided to quit work before the start of the overtime shift for, quote, personal reasons. Most significantly, according to Killen and Schimmick, each of the men claimed that O'Neill, quote, did not request or order any of the men to work over, end quote. 24 hours then passed. During the evening of Tuesday, April 14th, GM managers then met with O'Neill. They queried him about the events of the previous Saturday, and then at the end of the conversation, fired him. When O'Neill asked to see what information had been gathered during the manager's interviews with the repairman, interviews which said he had not fulfilled his obligations, William Killen refused to share the details. The firing took place on the order of Assistant Personnel Director Joseph Schimmick, who had briefly consulted with Robert Shans and William Killen. O'Neill responded by immediately filing a grievance, sending his case to the UAW Shop Committee and Plant Management for adjudication. The case required 2 days of meetings. Management maintained that the committee man was guilty of what they called negative leadership during the repairman's walkout on April 11th. O'Neill quietly acquiesced, however, at that point hoping to save his job. He accepted a compromise of a 30-day disciplinary layoff. According to the National Labor Relations Board, O'Neill did not protest the settlement. But after he had time to think about his predicament, he was likely very distressed by the fact that his coworkers' punishments, they had been given 1 week suspensions, which were reduced to 3 days. For O'Neill, he must have felt at that point that he was on the receiving end of arbitrary managerial harassment, which was in retaliation for others' actions. During the initial dispute, as well as the subsequent grievance deliberations, managers had singled out O'Neill for the harshest punishments. Did they assume that the union official must have been responsible for workers deciding to walk off the job? Did they want to punish the union official in order to send a stern message to other UAW committee men and workers that GM would respond bitterly to any job actions or walkouts that disrupted the workings of the contract and its no-strike provisions. Did O'Neill's co-workers give him up to management in order to save their own jobs and to mitigate their own punishments? O'Neill responded to the grievance resolution and managers' antipathy by filing an NLRB complaint on April 21. The trial examiner for the National Labor Relations Board in Detroit, a judge named Reeves R. Hilton, did not sympathize with O'Neill's claims. Instead, the judge in Detroit concluded that O'Neill was wrong to so cynically use the NLRB to collect lost wages after he had been rightly punished by GM for his negative leadership in the affair, end quote. I can find no merit or substance in O'Neill's case, Hilton wrote. It strikes me that having rescued his job through the grievance procedure, O'Neill then decided to try his luck with the board and attempt to collect pay for his 30-day suspension, end quote. Looking at the conflicting claims of GM and Wallace O'Neill, the trial examiner in Detroit concluded that O'Neill had a serious duty to actively prevent his co-workers from walking off the job against the wishes of management. Hilton concluded that O'Neill was guilty of not upholding and enforcing his union's contractual obligations, as management was entitled to expect from their relationship with the union. Hilton disregarded any suggestion of anti-union or at least anti-unionist animus on the part of the company. That trial examiner Reeves Hilton assumed the worst of Wallace O'Neill in his role as committeeman at GM and Pontiac suggests something of the deepening cultural and political influence of anti-labor conversations in government and the press during the late 50s and the early 1960s. In particular, more and more politicians and journalists in the 50s and 60s are viewing the institutions of organized labor as increasingly corrupt, authoritarian, and even criminal. Hilton's refusal to validate O'Neill's claims and dismissing them out of hand appeared to rest on his own presumption that the union official in the shop must be lying about his actions. The board itself, however, overturned Reeves Hilton's dismissal of the case in a 2-1 decision. Plainly summarizing the case, the board subtly pointed to the anti-union feelings that guided GM's and Hilton's views of O'Neill's actions. Quote, O'Neill, who was not personally involved in the dispute over overtime, was requested by company officials to persuade the men to return to work. O'Neill replied that the request came too late for him to effectuate it. As he left the premises, however, he spoke to several repairmen individually and informed them that he had been reminded by the employer of his duty as a committee man and that they should return to work. As a result of his failure to persuade the men to return to work, O'Neill was discharged by a respondent for violating the no-strike clause of the contract. The board, end quote, the board concluded that O'Neill neither caused nor took part in the work stoppage of the repairmen, ordering that General Motors must revoke the suspension and pay to him the wages he lost. But there was a dissent. Appointed by President Dwight Eisenhower to the board in 1955, member Boyd Leadham, formerly of the South Dakota Supreme Court, dissented. He said, quote, I would affirm the trial examiner and dismiss the complaint. O'Neill had an affirmative duty, which he failed to assume, to take positive action, as management requested, to halt the strike, end quote. Like the judge in Detroit, Reeves Hilton, Boyd Leadham argued that the UAW had violated its contractual obligations to General Motors by allowing the repairmen to leave the factory. As Leadham wrote in his dissent, quote, the union will not permit its members to cause any strike or stoppage, end quote. In light of this, General Motors was justified in its punishment of O'Neill. But O'Neill was restored. Not only does he keep his job, but he was given his wages back. But GM would continue to retaliate. And one thing that they were doing throughout the 60s, he's working in a tool crib, and management enclosed it with a chain link fence in the factory, and they put a light on the door. And whenever he left the door, the light would go on, and managers would be able to pounce on him and tell him to get back into the tool crib. So they weren't letting him leave the workplace. So they would continue to stick it to him in the years that would follow this case. The Wallace O'Neill case of the early 60s was only one example of GM anti-union politics on auto industry shop floors. Not only did GM managers' intermittent hostility and tension toward UAW committeemen point to the presence of anti-union feelings among management staff in the company, but so too did the development of contract rules in the 1950s and 1960s that were negotiated and subsequently applied that strictly curtailed union politics on the shop floors of GM plants. The contested arena of contract rules highlighted the ways GM management was continually looking for ways to blunt the politics of organized labor in its plants, trying to relegate the labor movement to the status of a silent partner in shop floor governance. And to illustrate this, I'm gonna talk about union bulletin board cases at GM Van Nuys. In 1962, auto worker Paul Joseph Goldener, who worked for GM at Van Nuys, California, filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board in protest against contract rules that precluded worker distribution of political literature on both working and non-working time, as well as against rules that banned the posting of any political information on union bulletin boards. Since the arrival of the UAW at GM Van Nuys in 1948, General Motors only allowed union bulletin boards to be used for specific functions, i.e. notices of meetings, notices of elections, recreational events, information about credit unions, and information about unemployment compensation, issues that the company regarded as, quote, bona fide union activity, end quote. Now, wording of these rules during the 1960s and 70s added, quote, the union will promptly remove from such union bulletin boards, upon the written request of management, any material which is libelous, scurrilous, or detrimental to the labor-management relationship, end quote. Paul Goldener's complaint argued that GM was guilty of discriminating against workers and the union by maintaining its ban of political talk. As the board summarized in its 1963 decision and order, quote, the respondent, that is GM, violated the Wagner Act by maintaining, in effect, shop rules prohibiting employee organizational activity on company premises at any time, end quote. GM argued that it could not be found responsible for discrimination since there was no evidence or complaints that any discrimination ever occurred in the Van Nuys plant. In other words, the presence of these rules could be overlooked since no problems had emerged during the course of their existence. Rather, these rules were mere formalities that harmed no one. However, the board responded that rules like these likely stifled worker expression in the factory, that the absence of overt conflict indicates, quote, they have operated successfully to inhibit the free exchange of ideas among employees, end quote. Even though the union had surrendered workers' right to strike in its post-war contracts with GM, the NLRB insisted that the company could not implement policies that precluded workers' rights to engage in activity related to determining their collective bargaining agents. The board concluded that GM could, quote, not maintain in effect shop rules which prohibit employees from engaging in solicitation in connection with union activities during non-working hours on our premises, or from distributing any written material on behalf of any labor organization on non-working time in a non-working area, end quote. Despite the NLRB's unambiguous conclusion that bulletin boards and distribution at Van Nuys should be open to political discussion, the issue remained a problem at the LA area factory. Paul Goldener filed a second complaint, this time in 1966, against management's continued formal prohibition of union and political talk in the plant, as well as managers' attempts to closely regulate the content of union bulletin boards. As a result of the 1964 contract negotiations between the UAW and GM, the rules that had been prohibited by the NLRB in the earlier complaint had been brought back. And at the same time, the language had been strengthened in some areas. Under Rule 92 that covered the content of the union's bulletin boards, for example, the wording of the contract now stated for the first time, the union will promptly remove from union bulletin boards, upon the request of management, any material which is libelous, scurrilous, detrimental to the labor-management relationship. But what was libelous or scurrilous? To what extent could workers voice any criticisms of their supervisors, their union, or the company? How inclusive were these rules and concepts? As they had done earlier in the era of the 30s and the 40s, General Motors management was continuing to look for ways to nullify the politics of the labor movement and workers themselves inside the factory, going so far as to demand that union officials police their bulletin boards for any potentially upsetting or critical political talk. In its approaches to contract deliberations, as these 1960s complaints to the NLRB suggested, GM leaders were hoping to defang the UAW and workers themselves to the extent that they could. The union's voice and the many voices of its members were to be policed and quieted. The NLRB, however, missed the anti-union dimensions of General Motors policymaking at Van Nuys, focusing instead on the need to protect workers' political rights in the shop so they could continue to question and revisit the issue of who would serve as their collective bargaining representatives. Paul Goldener was possibly a rank-and-file dissident, as suggested by the board's investigation. A skeptical board explained, quote, "We are keenly aware of the advantages that accrue to an incumbent union, and perhaps to an employer, from any agreement which prohibits employees from opposing the union by using the customary and vital channel of communication prescribed by the contract under consideration," end quote. Overlooking the broader anti-union import of GM's rules and its rebuke of the UAW's negotiation of the current contract, the board wanted to help Goldener to be able to put a stolid incumbent union on the defensive. Quote, "The union and the employees are and remain separate entities for many purposes. And the employees, by once selecting the union as their representative, do not forfeit their fundamental right to change their representative at appropriate times," end quote. Here the board was most concerned with how to prevent incumbent unions from stifling the political voices of their memberships, missing, however, the overall managerial effort to simultaneously quiet unions' and workers' political voices. The board continued to come across several instances of bulletin board policies that were intended to quiet the political voices of workers and unions in the 60s and 70s. GM managers would continue to reserve the right to punish workers and union officials who added or removed bulletin board content without the authorization of management. At the GM Tech Center in suburban Warren, Michigan, for example, Philip R. Jackson filed a complaint against the companies and the unions' 1970 to 73 contract, a document that stipulated punishments for anyone who tampered with union bulletin board space. The board needed only 4 short pages to repudiate the policy. These rules that called for, quote, "disciplinary action ranging from reprimand to immediate discharge," end quote, were presumptively invalid. According to the NLRB, rules such as these interdicted workers' rights to political discourse, as they constitute, quote, "prohibitions against solicitation and distribution," end quote. So in other words, workers can't put anything on the bulletin board. Now, GM is not only looking for ways to circumscribe the activities of the UAW on its shop floors, but also the activities of other union organizations in their plants, such as the United Electrical Workers Union. In 1974 and again in 1979, several members of the United Electrical Workers at GM factories in Ohio, New York, and New Jersey, including Frigidaire in Dayton, Ohio, filed complaints against the company's efforts to prohibit and prevent the distribution of political literature by dissident unionists. This is one important point in my research. What I'd like to get at is when labor historians talk about dissident unions, they're usually talking about the opposition of incumbent unions to dissidents. But I'm looking at how GM management was very much opposed to this, and it's indicative of an anti-union stance. As they had done in the past, the NLRB would side with these dissident workers in their efforts to level criticisms on those incumbent unions who represented them before the company. Much like the Van Nuys cases of the 60s, the board concluded that General Motors rules toward the UE were too sweeping, as they forbade any posting or distribution of literature by employees. While the board members focused in these cases on the rights of insurgent unionists among organized rank and file workers, they nonetheless included coverage of union management rules on the topic of union bulletin boards in the GM shops. The rules were very telling. GM intended for shop rules to interdict and constrain, to the greatest extent possible, the political dimensions of organized labor in the factory. The postings of incumbent unions, like the UAW and the UE, would be narrowly permitted to cover only procedural business or dollars and cents matters, not political issues or political talk, especially any political talk that criticized the company. Insurgent unionists who were dissenters, according to GM's rules, found themselves completely prevented from posting or distributing pamphlets, statements, platforms, etc. In fact, the 1974 complaint against General Motors by UE members alleged that the company unfairly prohibited the efforts of dissident unionists to distribute campaign literature during a union election campaign. GM anti-union measures by the 70s frequently stemmed from their opposition to the activities of these dissident unionists. At Fisher Body in Detroit, where auto workers manufactured Cadillac components, managers were using physical and even legal intimidation to suppress workers' efforts to recall an unpopular UAW Local 15 committee man in the winter of 1976. On two occasions inside the plant, foreman Dave West, Claude E. Caffey, and Albert Walco tried to confiscate, that is, they snatched and grabbed, dissident unionists' petitions and pamphlets in non-working areas. Supervisors even threatened one worker with discharge if he continued to advise workers of their, quote, rights to file grievances against the respondent, end quote. Queried later by the National Labor Relations Board, one supervisor remarked, "I don't like instigators," end quote. Labor historians have unintentionally minimized the significance of GM's efforts to roll back the Wagner Act in the post-war years. While they have acknowledged the company's southern strategy of the 60s and 70s and the company's relocation of various operations overseas as evidence of an anti-union prejudice within the company in the post-war years, they have not probed further in order to uncover the unionized shop floor as a significant site where anti-union politics played out. Sociologist Ruth Milkman wrote about management and union conflicts at GM's Linden, New Jersey plant as evidence of what she called adversarialism, but I would suggest this term does not go far enough to explain what's going on. General Motors was actively engaged in a process that would put various forms of pressure on union officials and would nullify the Wagner Act and its factories to the fullest extent possible. As an institution, evidence suggests that General Motors never accepted the UAW as a permanent resident adversary. Wallace O'Neill, the Fisher Body dissidents, and union bulletin boards were all, at one point, casualties of this fight in the post-World War II years. While the contractual problems over political speech and bulletin boards suggested the ways in which anti-union measures could be implemented in a systematic or standardized manner. Cases like the Wallace O'Neill case highlighted the seemingly random, volatile, and personal ways that anti-union culture could be made visible in post-war auto plants. Though not explained in the NLRB write-up of its decision and order, it would appear that managers had a particular distrust and disdain for Wallace O'Neill. His own punishments, after all, were significantly harsher and longer than any of the repairmen who actually walked off the job at Pontiac. Were managers at GM becoming increasingly unwilling to work with a union that was unable to completely control its members? Was O'Neill someone who managers regarded as an especially troublesome figure in the factory? Obviously, managers initially wanted to get rid of him in a very conspicuous way, perhaps to put the union on notice at Pontiac. The politics of bulletin boards in the auto factories suggest the extent to which managers hoped to minimize and constrain the presence and the voice of the labor movement in post-war industry. By trying to force the union to allow only bona fide issues, such as notices for elections and meetings, to appear on its bulletin boards, managers at GM actively tried to take the politics out of the labor movement in the unionized auto industry. There was even a fight in 1967 at Van Nuys. The union was asking for an extra key for the bulletin board, and the company spent weeks trying to tell them no, that they could not have an extra key for the bulletin board. In conclusion, the conversation among labor and working class historians about anti-union practices neglects the events and the periods of time that follow unionization, or the failure of organizing drives among unorganized workers. Just as labor historians' analyses of anti-union politics in the contexts of government and the media suggest, anti-union measures are truly ongoing. Even in the context of workplaces that are dismissed by labor historians as already organized with secure unions. At GM, unionization did not end the union and management conflict. It only segued into new arenas. GM would still be engaged in shop floor struggles against the UAW in the decades that followed the sit-down era. Thank you.
Okay, well, I've got some hands back here, but first let me say those sign-in sheets, do send them around again just for the fun of it. And I wanted to thank our co-sponsor today, by the way, is the Lansing Stewardship Community of Motor City's National Heritage Area. If you want to hear more about what this division of the Park Service does to tell the stories of auto workers and the automobile industry here in Michigan and across the nation, let me just introduce Brian Yap in the corner, who is one of the staff people of the National Heritage Area, and he can talk to you afterward if you're interested. So with that, Ken, your hand's up.
Being that I'm at the early stage of my research, I'm curious as to what extent these issues are playing out at Ford and Chrysler as well. I know at Ford, because I'm starting from these published National Labor Relations Board cases, that's where I've begun to look at initially. I know that what I'm finding is relations between GM management and the UAW is more touch and go or tense, it would seem, in the 60s and in the 70s. In the 70s, though, at Ford, there's a proliferation of cases involving rank and file dissident unionists. And Ford managers there are being fairly heavy-handed in their snatching of political literature from dissident workers and stuff. But so far, what I'm finding is that that's where I've been able to begin. And I started with the O'Neill case and have tried to follow it up in the archives at the UAW collection at the Reuther. And I'm finding that it's taking me so far a very long time to wade through a lot of the records. And what I'm finding is very telling references to a lot of problems in the GM grievance files. Committee men are writing letters to the GM department of the UAW saying, we feel harassed by management here. Is there anything you can do to get them off our backs? Especially new committee men are finding in the 60s that it's almost impossible for them to do their jobs, because if they're writing up grievances, management is accusing them of running up the grievance number. So
you're saying you haven't looked in the Ford files yet?
I haven't been able to look at Ford and Chrysler yet, because I'm still trying to sort out the milieu in which cases like the Wallace O'Neill case and the GM Van Nuys cases. I've been able to look at those so far.
Pam?
Why did the union ever agree initially to such language in the contract?
That's what labor historians have long lamented, that fact, that the institutionalization of the union blunts their political edge, because there's a lot of these privileges that General Motors or the union surrenders them to management. The union bureaucrats did that, yeah. And it's precisely right. The union officials find that they don't have very much leverage in their dealings with management. In the grievance procedures at GM, GM managers still had the final say. And on top of it, the union can't strike or do anything. And when workers themselves do that, the union, in effect, is put in the position of having to chase the workers back into the plant in order to avoid problems. So yeah, it's a Faustian bargain. So the union is able to become institutionalized, but at the same time, they surrendered their political weapons to management.
Well, just in passing, I mean, as an answer to Bob, and I love your comment on it, Greg, and the other people who have lived this life too. In collective bargaining, you know, there often are kind of competing goods that each side wants. So it very well may be that there were specific things that the UAW was willing to give up, in effect, to get other things. Things like dues checkoff, union security clauses, and other things actually, again, are not God-given or were not necessarily in law as much as they ended up being codified in contracts. So I'm not defending the fact that the union did it, but there, at various points in the history of collective bargaining, there are specific, in effect, trade-offs that have happened. And one thing I think that Greg raised, and let me just then get your comment on it, is the degree to which what almost might be called a pro-lapdog stance on the part of GM, that is that they want a union that they, even if they cannot control it, they at least want it staying within the bounds. And so it very well may be that some of those same union leaders wanted also a union that would stay in the bounds. So they had just as much reason to have restriction on bulletin boards in some ways as the company. So it very well may be that it actually was solving both, in effect, both sides' institutional power problems. But comments on that, Greg, and then over to...
Labor historians point to the 1950 Treaty of Detroit. So the contracts with the Big Three unions, or the union in the Big Three, emphasizes the significant gains in bread and butter issues like pensions, health care, wages, 30 and out, et cetera, and so on. But the union is surrendering its political muscle in some ways by
Amy?
Not allowing itself to strike.
Hi, just to add a little to the context, I'm a little tired. And I think one of the things that first of all, that the question on, you talk about dissident unions as opposed to, I assume, dissident caucuses within the union, mm-hmm. and I'm not clear always which one you're talking about, but that union, part of the problem with the Treaty of Detroit or the Grand Bargain or whatever is that in exchange for what it got, which was not insignificant, the UAW gave up the shop floor, gave up the right to fight, the right for the international to fight mm-hmm. over productivity increases, over shop floor safety, and even over a lot of movement within the plant, as long as it didn't violate the national non-discrimination language. And it pretty much cut each local loose to do the best they could with that. So locals were rather vulnerable. Okay. Mm-hmm. In addition, at Chrysler, we had developed what has come to be called the shop steward system, which was so important to GM that they didn't even let their lowest people be called stewards. They're all committing because the shop steward system at Chrysler was so strong it would strike on departmental basis in many plants.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing, the UAW was complicit in all this. You were so tactful, I'll have to learn that. That the UAW had been under, in other things like an international harvester, had been completely in competition with the farm equipment workers, which it finally managed to destroy between 1952 and 1955, and incorporate. And farm equipment workers, for example, had never accepted that they had to tell their people to go back to work. They said management rights clauses, I can't direct the workforce. But what the UAW had done was generally accept these things and gave up the shop floor. So they were a silent partner, and they were just as happy that GM was the bad guy in terms of workers who had different opinions from the administration caucus, the Ruther caucus,
mm-hmm.
than the caucus had. And so there had been dissident movements inside the union all the way back. I was wondering if your machine repairman was perhaps involved in the Independent Skilled Trades Council in the 50s.
The evidence doesn't get that specific.
Okay, I'm just saying that part of at Chrysler at least, what caused this uprising called the Dodge Revolutionary Union mm-hmm. movement was the fact that the union had given up the fight over speed up, had given up the fight over shop floor safety,
mm-hmm.
and that had fueled dissident movements from the 50s on. I think that contextualizing it a little more would give it a little richer background for people.
I think over time, as my research develops, I'll be able to do more with Chrysler and with Ford. There are cases in the 70s that the NLRB hears related to rank and file insurgencies, though not drum related. There'll likely be rich materials in the union archives to look at for that. I've been looking through the catalogs for files at the Ruther Library in Detroit for GM, and I have 7 pages of this box and this file that I want to go look at. And so it's going to take me a while to read through the GM material that I've started.
Glad to help when you get to Chrysler.
Pardon?
Oh,
thank you.
I'm just going to, other questions or comments? Yes, Bill?
Well, first, thank you. I think this was a very interesting presentation. And I certainly believe that the anti-unionism had to continue because it's certainly prevalent today. I'm currently a Chrysler worker and have been for 41 years. And have had to go to the NLRB, for example, for my rate to distribute material in non-work areas and a number of times, which the company recognizes as part of their shop rules, but
mm-hmm.
sometimes doesn't filter down to the plant level management and security. But I would say that there is a hierarchy of anti-unionism within the company.
So okay.
It may be always anti-union, but still prefers a partnership with the UAW International over dissident unions, dissident caucuses, dissident individuals.
Mm-hmm.
It would prefer not to have to have interruption to their plans for productivity, safety, investment, any of their plans, but they're willing to partner with the union if they think that the result of that partnership is control of the membership. So the where there would have been issues of people demanding the right to speak out evolved over time. So for a while in the 50s and early 60s, as I recall, a big center of conflict with the international leadership was through the Wayne County Tool and Die Council. It was elected local level skilled trades reps who disagreed with the Luther administration and tried to pursue an independent voice, which eventually the union just bureaucratically eliminated, similar to something that was done at Chrysler during the last decade. There then was a much more rank and file movement called the Dollar Now Now movement in 67, around the 67 contract, and passed that. And then by the time of the 1970 contract, you had an organization, the United National Caucus, which tried to pursue a campaign getting rid of the cap on the cost of living that was put in 67, and successful in pressing the union to fight that in 1970. So you had all kinds of issues, and they took different forms from union leadership, elected local leadership, to rank and filers, to attempt to organize caucus within the union. And each of these would have had their interest in communication within the plants. Mm-hmm. You would have had different reasons for keeping it out. It's interesting to me today, this certainly became clear with the vote on the Chrysler Council, or Chrysler contract, that much of the debate took place solely, entirely online. And the communication online now supersedes anything else in the plant. Leaflets, bulletin boards, whatever. Company makes pathetic efforts to tell people that they can't be on their phone during, you know, hours of being paid. People ignore that. A generational thing, perhaps, but people are not willing to be restricted on their access to, you know, public airwaves, and so the electronic media became the format for communication among rank and filers on the issues in the contract and led to the defeat of the contract, for the first contract. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things to look at in terms of how things have progressed, the context of it, as you said, but also how things have progressed today.
Well, I notice in my reading so far, trying to piece together the Wallace O'Neill case, it seems like grievance filings were a precursor to sort of rank and file movements, because workers are trying to work these established channels to affect changes in the conditions, only to find that when it gets to that last step that they're being overruled by the company. I even was reading one case that was interesting. Some jobs had been reconfigured and workers were having trouble getting their coffee break, and they were pressing for changes that would allow them to have coffee brought or have a coffee pot available where they were, and the company wouldn't even give on that. And so I could see how the grievance procedures in the early to mid 60s are sort of setting the stage for the kind of militancy that's going to bear full fruit in the 70s, beginning in the 70s.
Okay, let me call on other questions. One quick comment on that is that, you know, you've got a potentially a chicken or egg problem too. A lot of workers have always taken, in effect, work into their own hands rather than and then ultimately being told to file a grievance on that, you know. But one thing that's interesting, and others probably have this same experience looking at the historical record, which is NLRB cases are the very small tip of the iceberg, because very few things go all the way to board review. And in fact, even unfair labor practice charges, I think any given time, about 85% of them never go above the examiner or are actually settled out early. Yeah, even if they're found to have cause, which is why the grievance files, I think, are probably more fruitful for what you're looking at, even though having a good NLRB case or two as a major headline, I think, is worthwhile. The grievance files, I think Steve Meyer, if you've seen Steve Meyer's stuff, Steve's really mined the grievance files very, very heavily in terms of trying to understand what's going on in relation to the actual relationship on the shop floor. Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments for Greg on the presentation? One thing that I would historically, just so that we don't walk away feeling too bad, the thing that you pointed out, the board has upheld, and it's been upheld ever since, that you cannot punish a union steward or committeeman harsher than you can regular workers.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so that's the current law. All of us who kind of teach stewards training will point out that you cannot single out. I could not, if I had seven people who were being disciplined, I can't discipline the steward because he or she should know better, for example. Well, that's been around. Look at the Labor Law for the Union Steward book, and it's right in there in terms of you cannot do worse to them than you do to others. In that kind of regard. Now, you can, go after them in terms of what they didn't do or what they did do in their role. But again, as long as you're truly evincing your role, then you've got the protection of the act. I mean, so it just depends. Naturally, there are a lot of examples I think people can cite where things didn't work out the way they're supposed to. But what I'm trying to say is that the case law has actually been fairly strong on the idea that stewards and union representatives generally are on fairly solid ground. The one thing that comes into your story parenthetically without being named is Landrum Griffin, of course, comes in 59.
Yep.
And so with that change in labor law, that's where you really get both the rise of support for the possibility of dissident voices and at the same time higher reporting requirements, greater stringency of looking at union officer activity and so forth in this. Other comments or questions on all of this? Amy.
You referred to the UE plants.
Yep.
And these were plants that had survived the IUE raids.
You mean the IUE?
That's what I was wondering, because
the United Electrical Workers Union of the CIO.
UE rather than IUE.
If it's CIO, then it's the IUE. IUE. Because the UE was kicked out of the CIO in 50.
Yeah. And for whatever reason, the IUE represented at least one plant in each of the big three.
Okay.
Yeah, but very different, large difference between the two unions.
Okay.
Okay. Well, let us give Greg another round of applause.
Thank you, everybody.
And again, thank you so much. We'll see you same bat time, same bat station next week for William Rydell. And for everyone who came today that I've never met before, thank you so much for showing up. And for all of my friends who always wonderfully are here, thank you. And of course, I would be remiss if I did not say, go green for this weekend.
North American Labor History Conference.
Oh, it is also next week.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Yes. Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you so much for coming.